the correction could do right now, and it would not require an expensive new complex. Women also report how difficult it is to obtain medical parole. Since the passage of the medical parole law as part of the Criminal Justice Reform Act of 2018, PLS has filed 12 medical parole petitions on behalf of 8 women at MCI Framingham, and only one of our petitions has been granted. This is why PLS, following the lead of our partners at Families for Justice's Healing, is supporting a bill that would clarify and expand the medical parole process and also create a process for elder parole so we can safely release many of the oldest and longest serving women in the Commonwealth. This bill and other reforms like it are what the Commonwealth should be focusing on to promote public safety. Since the passage of the CJRA, the Commonwealth has made incredible strides to reduce incarceration rates, especially for women. A $360 million women's prison complex will take us backwards and undo our progress. Women incarcerated at MCI Framingham have also been clear that they do not want this complex. Rather, they want quality programming, reentry support, and meaningful pathways to release. PLS's mandate is to support the needs of incarcerated people, so we, like our clients, oppose this project.
That was Sarah Nawaba, staff attorney and Women's Incarceration and Reentry Project Director at Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts. She was preceded by Jasmine Borges, Director of Organizing and formerly incarcerated expert at Mass Bail Fund, and by Dr. Christine Mitchell, Health Instead of Punishment Program Director at Health in Partnership. They were speaking at a news conference September 11th, organized by Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts, to oppose Governor Healey's proposed $360 million prison complex at MCI Framingham, and to call for immediate action to stop construction, disclose all planning information, review every woman for release, and to improve current conditions. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just as so long. Long. Intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen, sponsored. Now become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late, everything here is great, but we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills, some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory, not because it's a must, but it's because this is the only place where you're hearing the right stuff. You're hearing the truth, you're hearing the good sound, and you're digging people who knows what it's all about. So pick up on a few things and lay down some of them other things and just dig KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And remember, I said so. I, Screaming Jay Hawkins. I ain't walking, I'm talking. I'm squawking. Become a member now. Become a member of KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm about to sign off. Bye, 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 bye. Bye.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts OB Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discussed African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO FM.
three, four. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Today I want to talk about an incredible book. It is insightful. I think it's on time, in time. We're talking about the memoirs of Robert and Mabel Williams, African American Freedom, Armed Resistance, and International Solidarity. One of the authors, Akinyele Umojo, is our guest. He's a professor of African American Studies. But more importantly, over at Georgia, University of Georgia, but more importantly, he's written a book about armed struggle in the South. You know, his book, We Will Shoot Back, talking about armed resistance in Mississippi, is a definite must-have. But before we get started with the book, Professor Moja, I think the process of putting this book together about these two iconic figures, Robert and Mabel Williams, we heard about them. People like to soundbite them, say these were folks that wouldn't take it, they will shoot back, all that sort of stuff, but we don't really know their full history. And I think the book really unearthed that because we're hearing directly from them. But I think just as important is the process of putting this book together. Oftentimes when we hear about projects being taken on, it's usually people who admire a particular figure, and then they come together and say, okay, I'm going to do the book, and they do the research. But this is kind of a revolutionary act because of all of the people involved. It seemed that there was a certain amount of intentionality. There was a purpose more than just for us to have good reading, and pulling together an Avengers type of team seem very important as well. And even the process, just the fact that there was a deliberate attempt to make sure that Mabel Williams' story is right alongside Robert. We don't have to go look for another book. Both voices are there. But talk about everybody that came together to put this book together.
Well, I appreciate that. And just to be clear, I'm a editor of this book, not an author. And I'm glad you started us there, because that's where it starts. This is the memoirs of Robert and Mabel Williams, so the audience will know this is their words, their writing. And I served along with Gloria House, Aneb Kogosile, known in the community in Detroit, and the great John Bracey, who's now an ancestor. We served as editors. We were selected by the family of and survivors of Robert and Mabel Williams to be the editors on this project. And it's a blessing, man. You call me an Avenger, so it's an avid comic book reader.
But it is, because
man of the Marvel Universe, I'm like humble.
But I say that
I only hope I'm T'Challa or Luke Cage.
No. I'll give you the Luke Cage look. I say that because I think it's important, because of the content of this book, to see that, in lack of a better word, this is a community endeavor.
Yes,
this isn't just Professor Umaji's thing. This is like a whole bunch of people, literally the Avengers, because any one of y'all can hold court. I could talk to you just about armed resistance. We don't have to talk about Robert Williams, and you can hold court. And John Bracey could hold court if he was still here. So I think it's important for people listening to understand, like, if we're going to do a project like this, maybe it needs to be more of a collective than just what I think. Because there might be blind spots.
It was a family's idea, actually. Truth be told, Mabel, before she passed, had approached me about serving as an editor of Robert's work. At the time, I was working on We Will Shoot Back, and I didn't have time, and I told her I needed to get that done first. And then when I completed it, she and her son, last surviving son, John, had decided that they were going to do it. And then, unfortunately, illness caught up with both of them. So in 2016, John, he only had six more months to live. He reached out to John Bracey and myself about completing the project. And other people were there. Of course, you would know Clyde Marks.
Yes.
At the meeting from Freedom Archives. Another brother, Charles Farrell, who was over at that time over the Charles Wright Museum in Detroit, was at the meeting. And the great Muhammad Ahmed, also known as Max Stanford, who had worked with them. They were on a meeting, and it was decided, as you mentioned, a community effort, and they decided that Bracey and I would work on the project. And as we got into the project, and it was really after John passed, his widow, Lisa Williams, made sure we got the manuscript and we began to work on it. And it was John Bracey who decided. He said, look, and he knew them better than I did. I met Robert one time, and I think it was like in, I can't remember the year, it was in the 70s, maybe 70, 78. I met him at a U.S. China Friendship Association, but I had heard him speak. And but Mabel, I had more of a relationship with. I could call and talk to. She would always talk to me when she came to Atlanta. Of course, we hosted her a couple of times at Georgia State University, where I work. And then, but Bracey said, this needs Mabel's voice. And he was insistent. And I, you know, we had just completed review doing Roberts, and I was like, man, let's go on and get this done. And he said, no, it needs Mabel's voice. And as my elder, I had to listen to him. And he was correct that we needed Mabel's voice there. And so we brought in a Neb, Gloria Neb House. And just for your audience, if you don't know who I'm talking about, Gloria House was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. For the folks out there in the Bay Area, she's an alumni of UC Berkeley, active in Lowndes County with great Kwame Ture, later joined the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, very active in the reparations movement still in the Detroit area. So she joined the project. She knew the Williams better than I do, but not only that, I would say working with her as an editor, she had more knowledge of English than I do. I'm a Ebonic speaker, bro.
Right.
Like I said, I'm from Compton. And so my father's from the Mississippi Delta. So I speak our common tongue. I can write in English, but but Gloria's more adept in it. So she really came in and brought that touch to it as well.
Right. You also mentioned Wanda Sabir from the Bayview, using her.
Yes.
And what caught me in the beginning of the book is seeing the quote from Mabel with the interview that she did with our own Walter Turner.
Yes, sir.
And that's what I mean. It's like, man, and then, of course, Claude Marx from the Freedom Archives. So everybody was brought together.
Let me speak a little bit about that. Because when we got Mabel's manuscript, it was only 21 pages.
Oh, and wow.
So, yeah, it was only 21 pages, and the story wasn't complete. So Clyde Marks from Freedom Archives had interviewed Mabel. Other brother from Freedom Archives who joined in and interviewed her. Wanda Sabir did an interview with her. That was in the San Francisco Bayview. We also completed it with an interview she did with the University of North Carolina Archives, because we wanted her story complete. And so we were able to triple that.
Right.
Given her. And then it's not as much many pages of Mabel's as Robert's, she includes key parts of the story, like like Robert's interactions with Malcolm X, like them Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. So like the role of women, not only in self-defense, but in terms of telling the story in Monroe, North Carolina, fighting against the Ku Klux Klan. So it were key parts of the story that Mabel was able to share that weren't included in Robert's manuscript.
Right.
Really complete the story. So, yes, community effort. Thanks for sharing that, because You're the first one to say it in that way, and I didn't think of it in that way. So it took your insight,
right?
As usual, David D.
Well, I appreciate that.
Historically,
I will say this too. In reading it, Maple fills a lot of gaps, but she also coincides, and it's almost like reading the Bible, you know, the Acts, you know, Mark, John, and Luke, and all that, right?
Right,
so they're
right.
All telling the same story, but you're seeing it from different points of view. And so I found that amazing too, to see some of her points of view versus Robert's. You know, Robert's like, I went down to the store, I had to do this, and then Maple's like, this brother ran down to the store, and then, you know, so you kind of see her perspective on things, and I thought that was pretty important to see that as well, I think, of her role in her education and what brings her in to political understanding. So a couple of things, let's get into the book. What amazes me is the frankness, and at this point in time, what we're experiencing is the sheer brutality of what people are going through in terms of the terror. I mean, the details that are laid out, the principal who comes to the school, the constant beating of Black folks. You know, walking down the street, just feel like smacking and kicking and brutalizing folks. The type of terror that is laid out is crazy. But I think we can look out our window right now. We're in California. I'm down in Southern. And you can see the ICE people. You can see that sort of thing going on. And so to me, that is, you know, to see that type of description.
Right.
And then to see their resistance is something that you got to sit back and go, wow.
Well,
can we build on that?
Oh, no. This, in working on this project in the context of the MAGA movement, because as I said, I met John to work on the project in 2016. That's the first administration of Donald Trump, and as we know, inside this country, particularly the reaction to the election of Barack Obama and the rightward movement in this country, the advance of paramilitary forces. So, you know, we remember particularly at the beginning of COVID, we're in Michigan, you know, which was the home of the Williams. You know, after they returned to the United States from China, the paramilitary white nationalist forces were going to kidnap the governor and hold her on trial. So I'm speaking to Lisa Williams again, the daughter-in-law of the Williams, and I mentioned, you know, wow, you know, look at all this happening. And she said, Akinyele, why are you surprised? You know, so, you know, working on this project and seeing the white terrorism that existed in Monroe, North Carolina, and then at the same time witnessing, seeing the emergence of this MAGA movement and the type of right-wing terror that we're seeing in our communities today, what we're seeing, particularly as we begin the book, the reason we chose to use the quote from Mabel Williams about the Iron Curtain on the story of the Williams lets us, you know, it's just a reminder that while some things have changed and a struggle of our people to advance human rights in this country has brought about some reforms, but at the same time, we gotta be very vigilant. So I think the book read from that perspective is very important. As I mentioned, one other thing is when I mentioned, when we talked to John Williams before he passed, he saw the emergence of what we call the Black Lives Matter movement. And he wanted communicated to that generation's lessons of his parents about, you know, that we have a right to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
we should look internationally for allies and friends, and the importance of as you do, telling our own story and being able to tell our story. Robert Williams, if you missed the fact that he is a writer, he's an author, he's a journalist, he and Mabel utilizing Radio Free Dixie to communicate our story, then you're missing, it's not just about the guns part of the story, but also about us beginning to tell our own story and being proficient at it.
Professor Moja, in the preface, you have that quote about the Iron Curtain.
Right.
And it's pulled from the interview she did with Walter Turner.
Yes,
you
sir.
Know, right,
yes,
here on our very own KPFA.
Yes, sir.
This Iron Curtain is not just the FBI and COINTELPRO that wanted to keep their story hidden, but a battle with a lot of Black folks, you know, from almost the get-go with the NAACP,
right,
which is detailed in great, great, I mean, it is like, that should be a movie, you know, in itself.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about that. What was the concern that their stance and their activism in North Carolina from Jump Street was causing grave concern with the NAACP?
Well, if you look at it, I mean, the NAACP on one hand has always supported the right to self-defense. A lot of times we mistakenly think that the NAACP was committed to nonviolence. It wasn't. But on the other hand, in development of the NAACP, from the inception of the NAACP, you have a national leadership that tended to be petty bourgeois, and I won't use that term, let me use another one. You tended to be elitist in the context of the Black liberation struggle. You know, so it relied upon work in the litigation arena. It relied upon lobbying elements in the ruling circle in the United States to try to bring about change. And it comes in contrast to local NAACP activists who tended to be more militant, Robert Williams being one of them, Meg Evers being another. And so
we can't forget Fred Hampton.
Fred Hampton, you're right.
Chairman Fred Hampton.
Good point. He was in Chicago, leader in the NAACP. So you're right, it has these grassroots activists, right? Because people are looking for spaces to be able to fight back. But oftentimes it doesn't represent the hierarchy that was situated in New York at that time. At that time, it's Roy Wilkins who's head of the NAACP. So there's a challenge with grassroots, more militant activists and the people who are in hierarchy. So when Robert Williams, particularly faced with sexual assault against Black women that he couldn't get justice for in the legal system, as an advocate for these particularly two sisters.
Well, let me make sure people heard you clearly.
Right.
There were sexual assaults by white folks, men, against Black women, kicking women down the stairs. The brutality is just crazy. And every time, as we see in the book from both Mabel and Robert, every time they go to the judges, they're like, dismissed.
Right.
And so finally, he's like, well, we'll handle it ourselves.
Right, particularly when the community's coming to him and say, look, we wanted to handle this ourselves, Robert, but you said take it to the courts.
Right.
His response was, this just shows if we can't get justice here, we're going to have to meet violence with violence.
Right.
Of course, the NAACP conservative leadership had a fit about that. And on the other hand, on the street, in the community, in the barbershops, in beauty shops, in bars, Robert Williams became a national hero. So there was that tension there. We also want to keep in mind that there were NAACP leaders like Thurgood Marshall, who we generally revere as a hero, on the other hand, was informing to the FBI about the activities of Robert Williams. So you have that conflict in the organization, elements in the organization who were more aligned with the rulers of the United States, trying to suppress or inform or collaborate against the activity of people like Robert Williams and the Monroe Movement. We say Robert Williams, but we have to recognize Robert Williams is a spokesperson for a movement that's happening not just in Monroe, but really across the country, because the Monroe movement was supported by people throughout the country, like a Malcolm X, who would invite Robert to speak at Temple Number 7 in Harlem when he's in the Nation of Islam, to raise money for him, like the great John Henry Clark, the historian, John Oliver Killens, the novelist, Queen Mother Moore, Grace and James Boggs in Detroit, who were activists there, C.L.R. James. There were other people all across the country who were supporting this Monroe movement because it was kind of representative that, other than nonviolence in Dr. King's movement, you also have people who are facing terrorism, the same terrorism we talked about a few minutes ago, and utilizing weapons to protect their communities and protect their lives. And so there was this movement across the country that's sending weapons, that's sending guns, that's sending ammunition, sending food to Monroe, North Carolina, because of course, you know, one of the tactics in the civil rights movement, when you had activists, they tried to starve them out. They tried to make it so they couldn't work, things of that nature. And the same was true of Robert Williams.
And we're seeing that now. Take them to court. Just sue them. Keep suing them, and then you bankrupt them, and then they got to go elsewhere. Let me ask you a couple of things. One, in putting the book together, so many of us, again, know the sound bites about them. What did you find really surprising with editing this book with the memoirs? What really stood out for you that you would tell people to pay close attention to, both from Robert and Mabel's perspectives?
Well, from Robert's perspective, the thing that really captured me was his desire to be a writer. You know, so all throughout his life prior to the movement, he's trying to write. He goes to a historically black college for a few years at West Virginia State, and he writes on the student newspaper at that time, the Quill. He's writing prior to that. He even submits articles to the Socialist Workers Party newspaper, the Militant. So Robert's always writing. The reason he joins the military is because he's hoping he can get the GI Bill so he could become a writer. So Robert's desire to be and his becoming a communicator, I think, is very important and kind of comes throughout the book. For Mabel.
Well, hold on. Before we go to Mabel, I think, tell me if this is a correct assessment. He understands that media is a weapon.
Yes, sir.
And I mean, from the stuff that he's doing with Radio Free Dixie and, you know, the Crusader and all that, he's just not writing for the sake of writing. He's like, these are tools that we must control. That's what I really pick up.
That we must control, and we have to advance, or provides us a platform to advance a particular type of position, because he is dissatisfied with the type of leadership we're receiving. He's dissatisfied with the narratives that come to the majority of our people. So he wants to see other perspectives represented. And so I think that comes quite clear with Robert. With Mabel, it's her whole trajectory in terms of her life being a young woman. She gets married young. I mean, she's basically still in high school when they get married, right? Mm. She's a student athlete. She plays basketball. But to see her political development, you see that a little bit more clearly in terms of her trajectory, in terms of being exposed to certain things, not only in terms of her relationship and her marriage, but working in a hospital where she sees conditions that she believes are genocidal. So you get a story of a young woman who not only grows because of, again, her marriage to her husband, but then just the space, excuse me, the spaces that she's involved in at that particular time, going to Cuba, and then to be able to meet a Che Guevara, to be able to meet a Fidel Castro, to meet Mao Zedong. So I almost feel like I become a young person who's growing along with Mabel reading her story.
Well, that's what got me too. Like, you're going on this journey, but what's really riveting, and I don't want to gloss over it, so maybe you can build on this, is her experience at the hospital. That seems to be a big turning point for her, because you're reading this and you're like, is this 2025 or is this,
right,
you know, 1930 something? But the conditions, maybe you can describe that, because you're like, whoa. You know, like, I'm can't believe this.
Yeah, she's in this hospital, and the conditions that Black folks, poor Black people, are going through in this particular hospital in terms of the treatment, the use of...
they're using dirty needles. They're using people who aren't qualified to do the needles. So it's like they can't do it on white folks, but they can do it on Black folks. They're in the basement. It is all these crazy conditions. And as I'm sitting here reading this, and, you know, and she's, her eyes are wide open now, like, yo, we can't be taking this. And she's talking about Robert would not take this, you know. You know, you can't take second-class citizenship. I often hear people say, I ain't my grandparents' civil rights movement. You know, they say that. And I'm like,
and I'm not my ancestors.
And I'm like, and I'm like, well, Robert Williams and Mabel were my ancestors. And the stuff that they were doing is stuff that I'm definitely not doing. Right. I don't have the courage that they did with the conditions that they had. But what do you think they would say to that sort of remark when people are kind of flippant, and in my opinion from reading the book, very ahistorical to what was going on? And the other thing, there's a romanticizing at the same time. I just read it the other day where people like, well, you know, maybe it's better off that we're just separated, because when we were separated, we were better off and we had these things. And I'm like, and I'm reading at every turn, like, I didn't want to be separated in that regard because it was unequal. But what would they say to this? Because this disinformation kind of carries the day.
Well, I think it's two things. No, number one, I think they were challenging folks even then to stand up. So they would, their response would still be to generations of young people who aren't understanding that genocide was and still is a part of our reality, something that we need to stand up and be about at this particular time. Now, Rob, this question of being separate, of course, during that time, they were living under apartheid. You know, they were separate, but we were kept, and that's what folks don't recognize. It wasn't separate, but equal. It was separate, and we were kept in genocidal conditions. We were kept in conditions, too, that reinforce us being in a so-called inferior status. I think, Rob, you know, it's...
Well, even going back to that, because I'm thinking about, you know, okay, you're separate.
Right.
And, you know, we don't have to deal with them, but you still have to interact. And that's when they go, well, we don't sell wood to you. And she's talking about it in her neighborhood. The pipes ain't coming to your neighborhood. The city pipes aren't coming to your neighborhood so you can have decent toilets. That type of, when we talk about separation, that's really what we're talking about. It's not just that we live in a Black neighborhood. I live in a Black neighborhood now. We're talking about, you don't have none of the stuff that your tax dollars go to is not coming to you. And that, I think, is
you don't have harsh reality. Access to resources. You're isolated.
Yes.
And at the same time, I think Rob was concerned about, and this to me comes clear to him after Birmingham, when churches are being bombed, and they're in Cuba at this particular point. Rob, you see his position become a lot more militant, a lot more radical, if you will. Robert begins to advance the necessity of Black people liberating themselves from this system. And he proposes the possibility of armed struggle, of guerrilla warfare. But ultimately, and this is one of the reasons that this whole question of separation is kind of a little bit more nuanced. He's calling. He joins the call for independent nationhood for Black people. Now, the type of nationhood he's talking about is not a racialist, because Rob was never a racialist in that way. But he felt that Black people needed to have their own territory, a state where we had some form of self-determination. So he would join the Republic of New Africa, and of course, was named their president when they formed the organization. But he's thinking in that matter even prior to that. But he's not alone in that assessment. One of the things we discussed, and we would shoot back, is that was one of the things that Medgar Evers considered himself, because they saw the genocidal conditions on Black people. They saw the white terrorism. And at the same time, unlike other people in the civil rights movement, they had lost faith that the federal government was going to protect them from white terrorism at that particular time. And so they, you know, their perspective of Black power would be one that we needed a form of self-determination, that we needed to have a territory that we can govern ourselves. And it wouldn't be a place that white people couldn't live. That wasn't what they were talking about. They weren't talking about excluding all white people from the places, but a place that we could have some form of control, where we could protect ourselves. That if we did have a government, that government would protect those who couldn't protect themselves. They would, you know, they would investigate who bombed the 16th Street right. Church in Birmingham, Alabama, things of that nature. So,
we're also talking about an ideology, because as you pointed out, you had people that. We have Black faces in high places, but they work on the benefit of white supremacy, of white ideology, yeah. European construct. So it's not just that. It's like it's a political understanding that would be represented by the New African Party, you know, Republic of New Africa, and all those organizations where you're not trying to be Clarence Thomas or even Thurgood right. Marshall in your right. actions. Right. The turning point, a couple of turning points that come out to me. One is the brutality towards kids, and I want to see if you could talk about the kissing case, which both him and Maple reference, which you just shake your head and go, wow, you know, some of that's being played out right now, you know, with the alligator Alcatrazes and what have you that have been set up. And then two, this internationalism. We now have a movement where people go, yeah, we don't mess with nobody. I don't talk to the Haitians, Jamaicans. It's just Black people here. And then I'm reading the book and I'm like, man, he's reaching out. He's like, I'm rolling with Cuba. I'm rolling with China, right. you know, right. And understanding that this not only strengthens numbers, but you also have to have these solidarities, because everybody's fighting for independence in one way or the other. And to move away from that is, to me, very interesting to see that happen in 2025, considering the type of, you know, ways we were able to fight in solidarity. So let's start with the brutality of the kids, the kissing case.
Well, those things are actually linked. In a way, the kissing case was a case of some children playing in North Carolina, Monroe, North Carolina, Black kids and white kids playing. And a white girl kisses two Black boys on the cheek, James Thompson, who's 9 years old, and David Sampson, who's 7 years old. And when the parents found out about their daughter playing with black boys and kissing them, the boys were charged with sexual assault, molestation, and they were both going to be placed in detention.
They were beaten. That's what got me.
Yeah,
they were straight up beaten.
And you had basically had lynch mobs around their parents' home. But so this is how threatening that was, I guess, to white folks at that particular point. But they were going to be placed in detention until they were both adults, until they were 21. And Robert Williams was informed about this story. Again, he tries to get the NAACP nationally to take it up. They wouldn't at that particular time, but he appeals to other forces. And Robert Williams, with his skill as a journalist, as a communicator, they began to put this out, particularly during the time of the Cold War, which, you know, at that time, you know, for listeners who weren't alive during that time, you know, you had this competition between the socialist bloc, the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc countries, and China, and the United States, you know, Western capitalist countries. And when it's pointed out this atrocity, particularly in the socialist world, points it out, then there's some action that begins to happen politically. And because of the initiation of the work by Robert Williams and others, they're able to get the federal government pressures the governor of North Carolina to commute the sentences of these young boys, and they would return to their parents. But it was, again, Robert Williams recognizing international politics and how that could be an agent. But even prior to him going internationally, Robert Williams' relationship with the Cuban Revolution actually was not because the Cubans reached out to Robert Williams. It's because Robert Williams and other folks like John Oliver Killens, who I mentioned before, John Henry Clark, Amiri Baraka, who's at that time, Leroy Jones, in the early stages of the Cuban Revolution, they had been members of the Fair Play for Cuba movement, which was getting solidarity with Fidel Castro and those forces in Cuba. Robert Williams, before he was in exile in Cuba, had been to Cuba twice and going around the country speaking on behalf of the United States having a friendly policy toward Cuba, which is still an issue today, right? Mm-hmm. and so Robert Williams not only was seeking friendship from folks across outside of the United States, but was, you know, being a friend to people.
Right.
In fact, it ended up being a friend not only because of his relationship with Cuba, that wasn't the only relationship that benefited him, but actually through that work, he made contacts with people in Canada. So when he has to leave Monroe, and he goes to New York, because initially he's thinking this thing in Monroe where there's a couple who accuses him of kidnapping, really engineer with the FBI and others to get him charged with kidnapping. He thinks it's something that's going to last a few days. He goes to New York. But then when they realize it's a national manhunt for him, he goes to Canada, and he's able to seek refuge with folks in Canada who he met through solidarity with Cuba.
And right.
Actually, it was the Fidel Castro, he would find out, put out a memo when folks are looking for Robert Williams in the United States and in Canada, that if he comes to one of our embassies, we're going to provide him with refuge. But it's also clear in the book that it's at the highest levels of the Cuban Revolution that Robert Williams was allowed to get on board to a Cuban plane from Canada to Havana during that particular time. They were able to secretly get him there. So he sought international support, but it was on the basis of not from an opportunist level that, you know, they could help me out later on, but no, he actually believed in freedom and justice and human rights for folks around the world, and he worked on that behalf.
Right. In other words, he had a politic.
Yes. He was an internationalist.
You know, yeah, right. You know, Professor Umoja, before we head out, and I have a million more questions, but I know time is short. You did write the landmark book, We Will Shoot Back. And looking at what took place with this Monroe movement in North Carolina, how much of that is an influence on what is going on in Mississippi, where so many Californians like yourself are from? And, you know, and then moving up to like your Deacons of Defense and what have you, all these Southern armed resistant movements that have literally been written out of history. You know, thank God for people like yourselves. You bring that up and you remind us that there was another way in which people got busy. But, you know, how did the, you know, what kind of unveiled itself to you when doing these books?
Well, man, a funny story. I interviewed a guy actually who was a white civil rights activist in Mississippi. He's from the North, was in Mississippi. But one of the things he told me that really had an impact on the way I thought about things, he said that when Rob was doing what he was doing, some of the folks he was working with in Mississippi said, well, why is Rob talking about these things? We're already doing them.
Oh, wow.
What makes Rob different is he is an advocate. He is somebody who's speaking about these things publicly. One of the things that I learned in my research doing writing the book, We Will Shoot Back, is it was widespread. There were Black people defending themselves and protecting their communities, protecting their families, protecting nonviolent activists. But right. Robert Williams talked about it and built a movement to advocate it. So it does become really outside of the South, more knowledge that you have people who are engaged in armed self-defense. Even another thing I learned, I mentioned Max Stanford, Muhammad Ahmed, he goes to Mississippi in 1964, and he's thinking as a member of the Revolutionary Action Movement, they're associated with Malcolm X, they're going to go to the South and they're going to teach people about the need for armed self-defense. He finds out they're already doing it.
Yeah.
One of the things he does is to try to, again, the people he's working with in 1964 in Mississippi, to get funding and support outside of the South for what they're doing. But Robert Williams becomes a spokesperson for a part of our people. You know how folks said they're not going to do, you got current generations, they're not going to be like their ancestors. You know, it's, you know, we have these myths about what occurred in the South, you know, particularly those of us who are not from the South, and what Black people are like in the South. And so Robert Williams was kind of challenged that notion, but because he's a spokesperson, we kind of think of him as the exception, you know?
Right.
We think of the Deacons for Defense as the exception. The Deacons become an organized force that publicly, at least they speak about it. We don't know who was all in the Deacons because they didn't tell everybody. Just like right. We all know who were in Robert Williams' guard.
Right.
You know what I mean? They didn't talk, about it.
As we should not know, and you all right. Talk about that. Right. You should know, right. You should know these folks, you know?
Right.
But I think it's important to kind of understand that people were always resisting.
Exactly.
Two, there was sharp political analysis on how to resist and have self-determination, which right. I think stands up, because we're not talking about something that is developed in 2016 after Ferguson or anything like right. that. We're talking about these analyses in the 40s and 50s, you know, and they still have a footprint on us today.
In fact, you know, folks from Ferguson, you know, who were involved in that movement, the Black Lives Matter movement that emerged again, even post, you know, in 2020, which what occurred after, you know, the killing of Mike Brown.
George Floyd.
George Floyd, man, we have so many. Oh, damn. But anyway, again, that's one of the reasons that John Williams, the son of Robert and Mabel, wanted this his parents' memoirs to come out, because he wants these generations to know what was done then. We have we forget and we don't learn about our history. And again, why, you know, that quote from Mabel is so important about unveiling this iron curtain of silence on this aspect of our movement. There's so many myths about what occurred during the Mill Movement, what elements were utilized to bring about the reforms we have today. We need more fundamental change, of course, to reach liberation. But, you know, there were some reforms that occurred, which is why you got elements like today trying to roll back what's taught in our schools and things of that nature. Having Black studies, women's studies, you know, queer studies in colleges and universities, trying to challenge so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, things of that nature, attempting to roll those back. It's all a part of trying to silence that history. And this particular history is really silenced, because you got...
Oh, yeah.
as you mentioned, you even got Black folks and so-called friends of the Black community who silenced this particular aspect of our history.
So. Yeah, as we close out, there's just a whole notion of, you know, when you are perfectly willing to defend yourself, there's a different set of equations that come into being. You know, you're just not running up on so-and-so. And I think, you know, the narrative that on one hand people had a kick out of going and terrorizing Black folks is shown in the book. And I think there's another habit that people are addicted to. It's like, oh, this poor old Professor Umoja, let me go pat him on the head and I'm going to come help him. And you have a savior complex. And then you realize, like, I don't need you to save me. Put some resources here and we can fight together. Then all of a sudden, I'm uncomfortable with that, because the savior thing is another form of control. It just seems like you fool yourself into thinking that you are being nice. No, I'm trying to control you. You know, you see that now with the passing of Hulk Hogan. You know, people going, well, he just used the N-word. I mean, we can move on. I mean, wow. No, I'm pissed off that he used it. You know,
right?
and now you have folks that are looking at you crazy, like, I don't understand. You understand,
right?
You just don't want to. But you know, that's, you know, racism, white supremacy are addictions that, you know, and afflictions that need to be eradicated, because they show up in the form of not allowing people to really be free. I mean, truly, truly free. So I think this book is a sharp reminder of that and gives us a blueprint, you know, from both Mabel and Robert on path that we need to take. So you all did a great job.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate it. And appreciate this opportunity to talk.
Salute to the Avengers.
Well, thank you. Thank you for, again, on behalf of the other editors and all the other folks who are involved in this project, we got to give them their flowers, too.
Well, we're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. The name of the book, Memoirs of Robert and Mabel Williams, African-American Freedom, Armed Resistance, and International Solidarity. Ralph and out. Peace.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Need and Davey D. Yeah, right.
feel me? Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on, check out.
Why every knob you stick they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Ain't nothing they made, they beats trying to eat, get it any from the steel crate, beef, say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I name with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Life is just like a bike, it don't move unless you pedaling. Less about who is better and more about who blessing them. Softer than gelatin, peanuts to elephants. You dumb as a box of rocks if you think it's irrelevant. My granny been popping Zanny since CBS met the nanny. My mammy Danny, she tripper than Annie. And I'm not talking to family, but I've been dreaming of fishing since I've been watching the Grammys. And I'm here to stay like in your panties. I need some standing ovation since y'all can't seem to understand me. I might look fly in the matrix, I hope I'm sticking my landing.
No need to bring fall back in August, September. You should just fall back in. Wait. Who wants to clear the fog and all the smog in your mirrors? Well, you could just fall back in. Wait. Delete your call log and clear your agenda. You should just eat what's on your
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, radio, South, man. Conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Top Ground Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side, learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Greetings, I'm Ansa Craigland.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donna Clark.
And we are The Meditation.
We are listening to Community Radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.
This is Bird Note. My name is Kelson Caldwell, and I drive a bus for King County Metro. As a bus driver, your schedule is pretty important. Sometimes you run late and there's nothing you can do about that. I was driving a route and I kept running fast, and then I would pull over to the side of the road and I'd just be kind of like twiddling my thumbs, worrying about what my passengers are thinking. And I wanted to find something to occupy my mind. And so I started to look for birds as my pastime. I was just like, oh, wow, look at those ducks. And then, oh, look at those crows. And that was kind of this weird entry point into becoming a lot more interested in, like, why are the birds going here at this time of day? And where do they hang out? Or what makes it possible for that bird to, like, stay here during the winter?
Driving the same route each day, Kelson noticed as new birds returned with the spring migration and how crows would fly off to roost together at night. Now, no matter where Kelson is, they see birds everywhere. Once you start paying attention to birds, it's hard to stop.
Though I will, mind you, I like keep my eyes on the road, obviously. Major part of my job.
For Bird Note, I'm Ashley Ahern.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi.